Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to the Best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. This edition was broadcast August 13th, 2011, and is presented by Paulette McQuarrie.
The BBC Far East Relay Station in Singapore performs an invaluable service to reach listeners in Southeast Asia. The station was built in the mid-1960s after the BBC was asked to leave Malaysia. The station operates 24 hours a day. At peak hours, all of the 250 and 50 kilowatt Marconi-made transmitters, with the name the BBC gave them, senders, are working. The large curtain antenna farm was designed to reach listeners in Southeast Asia, China, and the Pacific. And at one time, it was used for the BBC's service to Australia and New Zealand. Today, the station is not operated and maintained by the BBC, but is managed by Babcock Communications. The station is also used by other broadcasters, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, and Radio Japan, to reach their audiences. After waiting for a taxi in the rain for 15 minutes, Keith took the 35-minute taxi ride to 51 Turret Track in Kranji, located in the northwestern part of Singapore, to meet with Cindy Yao, the manager of the station, and Tan Lam Sun, the senior engineer. Both have been with the station for over 25 years.
Far Eastern Relay Station. We are now broadcasting on 6.195.
We used to have a control desk here that we get a radio feed for the program, and then they did update to satellite feed. So this is where the control bay, there's changes here. But on the transmitter side, there's not much changes.
But here from from this side, the control room side, back in the early days of the station, how were the programs coming in?
Back in the early day, when I came in, they get a direct satellite feed. Then we got a radio feed as a backup. And now we are using satellite feed. They use digital SMDS. And the backup use ISDN 9. You know? And the control bay equipment, monitor equipment, all have been removed. Mm-hmm. So we replaced with a small table there.
So like with this stuff now, how much easier is it compared to the old days?
It's much easier. Rather you do the last minute patching here and there, especially on the dock, you do announcement, all these things. No? Mm-hmm. So nowadays, you just leave it to the central in UK to switch in the announcement, everything.
So then over here, you have the computers that control. Now, these control the audio to each of the transmitters, or how does it work?
These three computer PC is basically for the PLC, control, download our program feed, mm-hmm. and schedule to the PLC. And the PLC will do automatic control switching on the transmitter on, off, switch the program in on the source, you know. And this way we do the remote controlling of the transmitter, a selection of radio, the audio feed to the transmitter.
And what about for frequency change? Is that also done in here?
Yes, it's done by the PLC. So the engineer has to go to the transmitter, put to the local remote, and then the frequency will do it automatically.
Have there been any slip-ups where you go, oh, wrong frequency? Or
once a blue moon. Yeah. There's some command failure, you know? So the engine, then the frequency alarm will come on to tell the wrong frequency there. So we have to go there manually, do the selection. Okay. It's not very frequent occurrence. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's actually just go to the transmitter room. Yeah. It's safe to go in. We're not going to get electrocuted or anything.
No, it's quite safe. Can feel quite warm.
Wow, I mean it's such a big difference. So let me ask you, the transmitters that are in this room, what is the minimum and maximum power?
We basically got two models here, the BD6122 transmitting at 100 kilowatt average power, therefore the RF carrier. B1623 is carrying the 250 kilowatts. Or then another model is BD272, the Marconi. It is 250 kilowatt transmission. So basically, there are two models here. One is your 100 kilowatt transmitter. The other one is 250 kilowatt transmitter.
How old are these transmitters? How long have they been used in the station?
Since
1965.
The transmitters were built in 1965.
So
after all this time, if something goes wrong, what do you do for parts? I take it that this company is no longer around.
As I told you earlier, that some of the parts we fabricate ourselves. You know, we have a workshop over right at the end of the hall, and the technicians are able to copy and fabricate themselves. If not, we'll get an outside contractor to help us. Yeah.
So would that be, for example, like the radio tubes or...?
The valve we still can get from UK. You know, there's certain capacitor, variable capacitor we still get from UK. And they supply it to us. There's more contacts, we usually make our own. You know, and basically we still can do it ourselves.
Now, you know, looking at this hall, just to describe it, it's a big hall. You have all these transmitters lined up. How often do you perform maintenance here?
We have daily maintenance carry out, you know, to check the transmitter, make sure the simple contact is working. Then we have some maintenance schedule to follow.
There are three shifts a day. The day shift, evening shift, night shift. And it's the day shift that do the maintenance work. Any fault reporting from the evening or night shift, the day shift will carry out the fault finding and problem solving.
You both have been here for a long time. When you think about the millions of people that listen to the programs from this station, you must be very satisfied that they're picking up a really good signal with, you know, very clear audio.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. No? You never expect radio from here can reach other parts of the world, especially to India, China.
I think it's a teamwork. Our engineers work well, you know, to keep this place, the site performing, our performance is good, you know, all the time, stay that at good level.
So, with this site, what is the main target area? Where do you mainly target?
I think the Asia, India, Southeast Asia, Indonesia. Yeah. These are quite many programs that go there. Yeah.
So how many staff do you have working in this station?
At the moment, 21.
21?
Yeah.
And at one particular time, how many people would be here?
For the shift work, we have two engineers per shift. Yeah. For the day shift, we have more people. Yeah. So we have two technicians, two admin staff, and the rest are all engineers.
And that's not just for the transmitters, but also for the antennas outside.
Yes, about four riggers.
Yes, I've forgotten about riggers.
To help maintain the riggers. Right. Sorry, to maintain the antenna in the field.
I see that you actually have one of them that is open up right now. Is this just going through regular maintenance?
Yeah, we open up to check the contact, make sure everything is in the proper order, ready for the imaging transmission.
How are these cooled?
Basically, this water cool and vapor pool. You know, the water are feeding from the glass tube, as you can see, and it's boil out, and the steam go up on the glass tube there, and it cool by heat exchangers there. And gravity, and when it condenses the water, we go into a conservator tank there, and it's gravity fed by the valve.
There must be times of day when every single transmitter is on, or do they only use like some at this time, some at this time? There must be times when you have every single one on.
Usually during evening time, at the peak hour, then all the transmitter will be on. Usually after 5 GMT.
From the schedule, I can see that.
You will look at the schedule chart. Can I show you a schedule chart?
Oh, yeah, sure. We'll see the schedule chart. And we also see some workstations with some spare parts.
For the night shift, I think the transmission ends at 1:30.
No, 2 a.m. 2:30 a.m.
2:30 to 5:30, right? 2:30. During this period, the transmission is off.
This is how it ended.
May the 1st this year, specially modified stealth helicopters set off for Pakistan in the dead of night.
But how did it all begin?
This was a character unlike any we've
seen. You know, people think that international broadcasting, all you're doing is recording programs, setting the programs out, and that's it. But there's a lot more work to it than that. I mean, this of course, is probably the heart or the brain of any broadcast institution. The amount of man hours to go in, to use, say, 2-3 frequencies just to reach an audience on the other side of the world. It is quite incredible. I mean, you must have a personal passion for this kind of work, do you?
Of course. I won't be working 24 more years here.
So when you wake up every day, do you wake up and say, do you ever say to yourself, I can't believe I'm doing this?
Yeah.
Really? So when you're looking to make parts, how do you find somebody that can do it? I mean, because you said that some of the parts you designed yourself, but you must have to meet special, say, technical requirements and safety requirements.
Of course, we try it out first, you know, test it out, see whether we can stand it. Can we walk this way? No. Maybe it works, then we fabricate all the parts. Careful.
So with all the RF that's generated here and in the in the transmitter hall, are you limited, let's say, to the amount of hours that you can spend in one particular area?
No, because I think it's quite in a safe level, you know? So I don't think that's an issue. Especially we're walking around the area field, I don't think you get RF burn unless it's staying directly underneath that area that rating 250 kilowatt for
right.
a few hours, you know? And that won't be happen.
Ah, okay.
Most of them we are moving about.
So, like, say, have you ever come out here? And do you have a shortwave receiver?
At home, I have. I used to monitor. No?
Yeah.
So not in the office here, because if your transmitter on, you will jam out the shortwave.
Right.
So it's no point. This is an area feed.
So what about these feeds as well? How often do you change these feeder lines?
No, you don't change it unless it's burned.
It's burned.
Careful. Yeah. So far, it's quite lasting.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, you get horizontal feeder burn, all these things, so we replace it.
And you know, considering that Singapore is in the tropics, what about lightning strikes?
Very lucky we don't get strike.
Okay.
But I think, yeah, it happened once. In the Ted Tower K, you know, but that's the only thing I think I can recall is right there, and our transmitter hall, the roof.
Right.
You know. So, but for safety reasons, as they say, it's overcast, then we don't do any work in the field. You know? They say heavy rain coming or lightning coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the golf club providing a service, you know, when riding along approach, when any riding approach, they sound alarm, so we know.
Okay.
Time to go on the shelter.
But you know, something that is quite, you know, you're lucky. I mean, there's other countries, they have certain things to contend with this kind of station, either it being typhoons or cyclones. Singapore is very lucky like that because you don't have, let's say, the same kind of typhoons that would, let's say, affect Indonesia, the Philippines, or Taiwan. You don't have cyclones like you would, let's say, in parts of New Zealand where Radio New Zealand has been taken off the air because of cyclones. So here you're pretty safe then.
Yeah, I agree with you. You don't face typhoon, earthquake, all these natural disasters.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's not an issue here. No? And you don't face flood here, so it's quite safe.
Right.
What a safer place to be.
The rest of the world could be coming down. Just come to the Far East Relay Station and you'll be safe.
Yeah, come to Singapore and stay.
Deutsche Welle. News.
This is Mark Hallam in Bonn. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced that politicians in Washington have agreed on a deal to raise the country's debt limit and avoid default. The deal will cut about $1 trillion from government spending over the next 10 years and establishes a...
And I was speaking there with Tam Lam Thun, who's the senior engineer. And we also heard in that piece Cindy Yao, who is the manager of the station, who started off as a secretary many, many years ago. Both of them certainly do have a passion for this kind of work. Anyway, in a few moments, actually, I'll be heading back to the downtown area of Singapore, probably near Orchard Road, to do a little bit of shopping. I wonder if I can get a taxi. That's the only problem here. This area, by the way, is really cut off. Now, when I showed up today, I saw something that was rather unusual, There was no signage outside, but we're going to walk in front of it again. It's completely closed off. It also is a relay station. Well, an abandoned relay station. It was the relay station once used by Radio Singapore International. And I was asking Tan about it, and he told me an interesting story. He said the station was built in the early 1990s with brand new ABS transmitters. When Radio Singapore International closed, they didn't sell off the equipment. No, 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 no. They didn't do that at all. What did they do? They dumped it. That's right. They dumped it. They threw these beautiful, brand new transmitters, only a few years old, into the scrap heap, as well as the antenna masts and everything else. And all you can see now is the building that was built to house the transmitter hall and the offices and the main gate. Everything else has been abandoned. And he told me, he said, if the BBC was approached to take over the site and use it, he said they would have jumped at it because it was so modern, but they just dumped everything. I don't know why they would do that. Anyway, you are listening, of course, to Media Network Plus. If you'd like to see pictures of my visit to the BBC Far East Relay Station, just go to www.pcjmedia.com and you will find a link. You can also find the pictures at the Facebook page for PCJ Media and PCJ Radio. Just do a search on Facebook and you'll find them, and that's all you need to do. So, as I now walk for another 1.5 kilometers to the main road to try to get a taxi, I think I might have to hitchhike. We're now going to cut back to Paulette all the way in Vancouver. Aku cari kanan kiri laki gagah yang menari bossa nova sungguh gampang hati senang jika sudah. Next week, Keith will join us again from Singapore to talk about the local radio scene. We now move to the United States. WILD Radio was the scrappy little engine that could. A small budget radio station with big ideas in its 40-plus years on air, it earned a trusted place in Boston's inner-city community. But now, that's gone, and the station serves a very different audience. Here's Dolores Handy from National Public Radio with the details.
In the 1980s, WILD AM 1090 was the hotspot. If you wanted to find out what was happening in the city, you'd tune in.
BET's Comic View. It's happening September 28th.
If you needed to get information to the African-American inner-city community, even to just a lone teenager out of touch with her family.
Give your mother Charlene a call. She loves you.
Missing you.
Waiting for you to come on
in. The red brick building on Warren Street across from Roxbury District Court is where you'd go, whether you were a concert promoter, community activist, or politician.
And Mayor Menino, want to thank the mayor for coming by, bought us some flowers, sent us some love.
The coach, Willie May, was sports director and morning co-host at WILD for 22 years. He recalls the good old days.
We made some great strides. I mean, everybody wanted to be a part of it. I mean, here you had this little radio station that was a daytime radio station and really made some great things happen. I remember back in 85, we won Best Morning Show from Boston Magazine, which was huge.
And just about everybody came through.
Luther Vandross, I remember, came on the coldest Veterans Day back in the 80s, and the line went out the door, around the corner, up the hill, because everybody wanted to see the late, great Luther Vandross, and he was great.
But that's all changed now.
Shows don't even come to town hardly anymore because promoters don't feel as though they have a way to get the word out to people to come to their shows. So you don't see as many African-American concerts here in Boston anymore. And it's been like that in a big, big way the last 5 years or so.
He echoes what many in the city are saying, that the voice of the community is gone. What's lost, says Coach, is more than a brick-and-mortar building, more than a radio station with a great playlist. The loss of WILD is especially felt when it comes to news, entertainment, and cultural events now that WILD has been reprogrammed.
Live from the Chinese capital each weekday, the latest local and international news.
That's right, China Radio International, as of June 1st, is the new sound of WILD. The station is targeting new Americans. What you hear now when you tune in to AM 1090?
I want to learn Chinese.
One of the reasons WILD is no longer on the air is that the marketplace has changed. The competition is greater. What's happened to WILD is not surprising to media observers like WBUR media analyst John Carroll.
I think it's a reflection of what's happening in the radio market overall, which is a movement toward consolidation, a movement toward nationalization or internationalization, a movement away from local community presence on radio stations and more toward major conglomerates, which are much less expensive to operate. And one of the issues is, can anyone make the FCC care about this?
The Federal Communications Commission says it's not aware of the change in programming at WILD. Radio One, which holds the WILD license, has a local marketing agreement, or LMA, with Douglas Broadcasting, which is airing China Radio International. Radio One is not required to report that LMA to the FCC. Douglas Broadcasting says the new programming at WILD is an experiment. The company president, Greg Douglas, says he has no plans to sell commercial time. He would not say whether his company is being paid by the Chinese government to broadcast the programming.
And this edition of Media Network Plus was broadcast the 13th of August, 2011. Now, actually, a new story concerning the Asia-Pacific region. The largest global grouping of public broadcasters say Nauru's ban on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation journalists attending the Pacific Islands Forum Summit is completely unacceptable. The president of the Pacific Island Media Alliance, Paul Thompson, who is the chief executive of RNZ, that's Radio New Zealand, says the ban strikes at the heart of the integrity of the forum. The Nauru government issued the ban earlier this week, accusing the ABC of false reporting. In the wake of the ban, there have been calls for a media boycott of the summit, and Don Wiseman asked Mr. Thompson if there is something he would endorse.
I don't think it's the PMA's role to endorse a boycott. I think that's up to individual broadcasters. But what I would say is that, wearing both my RNZ chief executive hat and my PMA hat, that what is happening in Nauru around this banning of the ABC journalists is really worrying. It's a brazen attempt to chill those journalists and completely unacceptable in terms of, you know, the Pacific Forum's role as a regional body and Nauru trying to control who can go and report on it. I think it strikes at the heart of the integrity and openness of the forum. I'm really concerned about it. RNZ will be sending a reporter to cover the forum, and we will be making all of our journalism, hard-hitting journalism, available to our colleagues at the ABC. So, you know, I just want to make that clear that we're going to go there and do our job and make sure that news gets out.
There's a lot of stories that any journalist who goes to Nauru would like to talk about and would like to talk with people there about. But one of the other things that Nauru has done in recent times is introduce a contempt of court law that effectively muzzles everyone. It stops people from being willing to talk to the media. What does the Public Media Alliance think about that?
Look, we see problems with media freedom in many areas of the Pacific, and you just need to look at what's happened in Tonga in the last 12 months to think about the challenges that the media face doing their job in this part of the world where so many big stories need to be told. So I look at what's happening in Nauru, and what you see is a government that's trying to close down dissent and debate and misusing its power to keep its people in ignorance and stop the other countries and other parts of the world understanding what's going on. So I think it's an appalling overreach by the government and reflects very poorly on the quality of democracy in that part of the world. And, you know, whether the Pacific Forum members see it like this or not, by going there and hosting the event in Nauru and allowing that ban on the ABC journalists to stand, that they are endorsing this loss of freedom of speech and media.
The New Zealand government's been taking in recent times a fairly conciliatory approach to what's happening in Nauru. Is this the right approach?
I'm not close enough to it, and I don't know enough about it to give a considered view on that. But clearly New Zealand needs a relationship with Nauru, and I'm sure that there are various discussions going on which are designed to improve the quality of democracy and government in Nauru. But, you know, I do also think it's up to New Zealand to defend freedom of expression throughout the region, which is such a pivotal part of how we operate as democracy, and it's part of what New Zealand wants to support to ensure a healthier Pacific. So if Pacific nations fall down in freedom of expression, that cuts to the very heart of their effectiveness as democracies and the health of the region. So I think that's a message that New Zealand should be giving.
Now, Nauru has in place an effective ban on journalists going there outside of the summit. It has this visa application fee of $6,000, a non-refundable application fee. Very few journalists have been there in the last several years because of that. So it becomes an effective ban. It's been waived, I think, because of pressure from the forum for this single event, but I would imagine they're going to reinstate it once everyone leaves. What would the PMA say about that?
Again, it's unacceptable and reflects very poorly on the quality of democracy in Nauru and the behaviour of the government. You have to ask the question of what are they trying to hide? They obviously have major problems that they're dealing with or not dealing with. You know, I would argue that good, honest, direct, robust reporting would actually be really good for Nauru in the long term, but in the short term, they're trying to keep a lid on it, and that never works in the long term.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Let us know where you heard the program. Our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pellow, wishing you all 73 and 88 to the ladies.